The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk. Coming up on this week's show, it's all for you, as Andy Duncan announces plans for a new £50 million fund to support public service content. We'll analyse the bold intentions at Channel 4. Also in the podcast...
It's just one of the questions, but it's an important one to ensure that formats are as universal as possible. They're not going to be, because, of course, great big markets like the United States of America have satellite radio, and that's a kind of self-contained market in itself. But in Europe particularly, it's an important thing.
It's the format stupid. We hear from Andy Parfitt about the future of digital radio. Plus, money for nothing or your content for free. We'll discuss the next generation of TV, video and online newspapers as we round up the news from this year's Media Guardian Changing Media Summit. All this and much more coming up on Media Talk from The Guardian. I'm back, a week too late to make a joke about my secret tour of duty in Afghanistan, but thank you to John Plunkett and Robert Freeman for holding the fort with such aplomb. There's less of a panel and more of a panellist this week, but they don't come any better than Emily Bell, the Guardian's Director of Digital Content. Do you like our new theme tune, Emily?
I think it's very electroclash. Early 80s Kraftwerk. It's very good, very modern.
Better than the old one anyway. It's best that can be said.
I like
for
the
it,
whistling.
I
might have to start whistling just anyway.
But... let's get on to more important matters than the whistling. When Channel 4 turned 25 last year, the anniversary prompted much head-scratching about what the network was actually for. Had it lost its way? Had it become consumed by the big beast of Big Brother? Did the management really know what they were doing? Well, this week, Channel 4 hit back, setting out a major statement of principles about how the network sees its role in the digital future. And you can't move for the words public and service. Chief Executive Andy Duncan outlined plans for a £50 million fund to support, quote, public service digital media content, unquote, over the next 2 years. And he promised to show more new programmes in peak time than any other public service broadcaster. As part of the catchily named For Innovation for the Public Fund, it'll show at least one new documentary in peak time every weekday, and increased spending on news and British films. Owen Gibson, the Guardian's media correspondent, is here. Owen, you were at the launch. What did you make of it all?
It was very slick. You know, Channel 4 have always been very good at marketing. They had all their ducks in a row. They made sure Kevin Lager didn't speak for too long and say the wrong thing. The thing that struck me was the very last sort of montage of sort of stirring music and quotes from absolutely every constituency that they'd hoped to hit with this. So they already had Andy Burnham lined up saying what a great thing Channel 4 was. They had Lord Putnam, the soul of old Channel 4, saying what a wonderful institution it was and why it deserved to survive. And then they brought on Ed Richards, and he says, oh, what a marvellous thing this all is. I mean, I just thought, you know, we could all pack up and go home. We've had all the arguments, and we just need to work out how they're going to get this pesky £150 million to bridge the funding gap they keep going on about.
Well, you mentioned Ed Richards, the chief executive of Ofcom there. Coincidentally, this week, Ofcom quietly announced that their public service publisher idea was dead and buried, and that was not dissimilar to this £50 million fund that Channel 4 are now going.
So exactly, yeah.
Centre of a carve-up?
I mean, I think if you were being kind to Ofcom, which let's not know, but you might say that they raised the idea, that it then seeded into the mainstream, they've now influenced what Channel 4 brought before us. But, you know...
Well, Channel 4 had always argued that was what they should be doing, that even right from the beginning. So it's very disingenuous for Ofcom to say, oh, we seeded the debate, because Channel 4 always said
it's a bit chicken and egg. I mean, Channel 4 was very late into new media. Right. They, you know, if they'd have done all this 5 years ago, there probably wouldn't be an argument now. We'd all be sitting here saying what a relevant and cutting-edge organisation Channel 4 was and why we still needed it in the new age. But they didn't. It just feels a bit of a letdown in a way. The original Ofcom PSP idea was actually quite a bold. It would really shake things up, and it was all about new structures looking 10 to 15 years hence.
You could
all the talk now is of you know, just remodelling the old structures around the edges, giving Channel 4 a little bit more money here, holding ITV even some of its old promises there, he was talking about this week. And it's just, it just feels a bit sort of low level and kind of, and I wonder whether it'll be enough to maintain it.
You could argue though that the problem with Channel 4 is that it hasn't had a proper identity. Is it a public service broadcaster? Is it an entertainment channel? A bit of a hybrid. It had all that trouble with Big Brother last year. At the very least, this is a clear statement now. They're saying very clearly that they want to be a public service network. There's no ifs and buts about it, and it'll go through everything they do, from Channel 4 to E4, More 4, the radio. They're now being very clear about what the vision is.
It's a clear statement. They've said, here's what we hope to be. Here's the standards by which you can measure us. Here's a range of new sort of accountability processes that we'll put in place to help you to do that. But it doesn't solve actually that central conundrum at the heart of Channel 4, and which is partly what's made it, you know, a great broadcast down the years, but partly why it's finding things so difficult now, which is, as you say, that balance between the commercial and the public service is still going to have to perform that balancing act if it's going to bring in enough money to survive. You know,
Emily, what do you make of all of this?
Well, it's a folding by Ofcom on their very sort of very strong principles about what they thought the PSP should be. Because if you go back and you look at what Andrew Chitty, and indeed friend of the podcast Anthony Lilly, was saying about this only a year ago, they were saying PSP, it will not be a fund for an existing broadcaster. It should be a construct that lives in a completely new space. I have a feeling that Ed Richards and his team have been got at by backbench MPs and broadcasting lobbyists. And as Owen said, 2 days before this announcement comes out, you have the quietly sort of, you know, opening a drawer and putting the PSP in it and shutting the drawer. And you now have Channel 4 saying, we will have this £50 million fund. We will be a commissioner. So hooray. I'll be down there tomorrow. Andy, I know you'll be looking forward to seeing me. And it does feel to me, how you feel about this entirely depends on how you feel about Channel 4. And if you think we should be preserving existing institutions in a new world into which they don't necessarily fit, then I think you'll think this is a great thing. If you think there was an opportunity here to do something really, really new, I think you'll be feeling, probably like Owen and I, slightly disappointed.
Although there were those of us who criticised the PSP for being not clear about what the idea was for. At least it was quite different from anything else. Perhaps that's why people found it quite difficult to grasp, because it was so different from anything else that existed.
Well, it feels to me what they've tried to do here is as I mean, to sort of conjoin the two ideas together, and they say, and Channel 4 are saying, you know, what they did for independent production 25 years ago, they can do for the new media sector now. But I just think the whole thing's so much more diverse, complicated, international, that it's a very different transaction. I mean, that was a very pure thing to do, to sort of spark a whole new sector that was a very commercial sector and all the rest of it. Now they're getting into bed with sort of regional development agencies, various government departments, and kind of, and it just all feels a lot more difficult.
I think that's a big question here, and I've always sort of applauded the, if you like, the boldness of the PSP idea without ever thinking it was going to be necessarily workable, because I thought that, well, one of the things that you have to prove in the online environment or the broadband environment is market failure. And there is no market failure online. Quite. But you could construct an argument that says, well, this is fine, this is 50 million quid into kind of creative ideas that go online. But then I just don't really get how that sort of intersects with Channel 4.
Finally, Owen, is this a bid by Channel 4 to plug that 150 million funding gap, which presumably hasn't gone away?
That's absolutely what it is.
And so,
yeah.
Where is that money going to come from? Still not clear.
Still not clear. And, you know, that was the kind of massive elephant in the room today. And everyone kept trying to bring them back to it. And they kept saying, we're not quite ready to talk about that yet, unless wait for Ofcom's PSB review. And you know, it's clear they don't want top slicing, because that would be a terrible, you know, it'd be a horrible row with the BBC. It would be really difficult. They still want some form of indirect funding. I think what we'll end up with is a whole load of free spectrum. A whole load of free spectrum that they can do with as they want. And they'll then try and sell on and use for various different purposes.
I still think that one way or another it'll end up coming out of the BBC pot, whether it's top slicing or something else. I just have this feeling, this gut feeling, there's been a bit of a shift on that as well.
Well, you can read more about this story and have your say at mediaguardian.co.uk. Thank you very much to Owen Gibson. Emily Bell is staying with us. And how about a sting before we move on? Earlier this week, we were at the Changing Media Summit, organised by Media Guardian. It was subtitled, "The Digital Revolution Has Happened, Now It's Time to Deal With It." Various luminaries and policy wonks pontificated on the future of audio, video, mobile and online. And several phrases kept on repeating themselves. Monetising content, Googleisation, YouTubeability even, and obviously 360-degree commissioning. Lots of stuff about brands and end-user experience as well. We'll come on to radio and TV later in the show, but because this podcast is brought to you by The Guardian, we'll start with print. And now, Emily, of course, has pioneered The Guardian's online business model, which is basically give it all away, isn't it, Emily?
It is, very successfully.
Very
simple. We've given it away very successfully.
Let's hear first, though, from two of the other big players in the online newspaper game and how they're proposing to make money in the web world.
Yen Chang, publisher and managing editor of FT.com. it's not a subscription model. It's a new access model that's much freer than it used to be. Anybody can come in and get our best content, from our news to our columnists and analysis, up to 30 stories a month, and they can keep doing that forever, and we welcome them to engage with us. If you want unlimited access to our content, then you need to get a subscription.
Hi, I'm Gordon McLeod. I'm the president of the Wall Street Journal Digital Network. Our subscription model is focused on certain parts of our sites that are you need to pay to access. That content is generally our most unique, valued content. So it's a different model than the FT, focused more on which content is available to which audience as opposed to being based on use.
The argument, though, goes that if you're locking people behind a subscription wall, then you are doing just that. You're cutting off potential audience, potential viewers. Why are you continuing to do this?
I agree with that argument. If you put what you consider your best content behind a wall, you're locking it out. That's not what we're doing. We're not continuing to do that. What we're doing is taking our best content and not presupposing which one you'll like or what's valuable to you or not to you, because in the internet, it's self-selecting. What's valuable to one user might be totally different what's valuable to someone else. And so we're putting all of our best content out there for people to get to know for free. And so it's a radical change from the model you just said.
Let me jump in. Our focus has been more on the fact that as more user-generated content and new sites are growing every day, that news content in general is becoming more commoditized. And we are looking for ways to add value and to distinguish our content from others. One of the key ways we do that is by having over 1.3 million people subscribe to that content because they feel it's more valuable and more unique than some of the other content they find across the web.
And to what extent are both of you kind of proactive or reactive to new technology? And most recently, there's been the iPhone. It's a new way of viewing FT.com or Wall Street Journal. How much can you second guess what's going to happen, or are you always playing catch up?
Speaking candidly, I think all traditional publishers are in both roles. We're reacting to new technologies. The internet was a big new technology that we had to react to, and we at the FT have in the past had to catch up, and we're really pleased with the last 18 months. We feel like we have caught up and really turned around our position. Now we're growing really quickly, and now we're in a position to be more proactive, certainly mobile and the different kinds of new platforms that are coming on mobile, not just iPhone, but others, present very interesting opportunities that we're looking to address proactively. Likewise, video. We've been very proactive at the FT in terms of growing our video franchise, and we believe that we're right at the leading edge on that.
We are a content company, and while we have a strong technology team that's helping us create and distribute that content, we need partners. We are not technology focused. With so much change across the web, with so many new audiences and so many new outlets, we're happy to work with partners. We work with a company called Lumia on helping Facebook users bring their network to our content. We work with Dig in terms of helping our users share our content across the web. We will always be a content company first and foremost, but it also enables us to work with many different technology partners to help us distribute that content.
Producer Ben there with the questions for FT.com's Yen Cheng and Gordon McLeod from the Wall Street Journal. Emily, what do you make of what both of them were saying? Is what they're doing right for their markets?
I think in the short term, yes. I think there's a question over whether or not you can carry on charging for content in the long term. I suspect what's happened with the Wall Street Journal, we heard lots of stories about Rupert Murdoch saying, I'm going to take the paywall off.
It seemed from what Gordon McLeod was saying that they're not. You know.
No, they're not. He's actually reversed out that and said we're not. I wonder whether it's because they've looked at the books at the Journal and they've also had a look at what's happening in the global ad market, which is going a bit soft, as Gordon McLeod said himself on stage at the Changing Media Summit. And they've thought, hang on a second, we've got lots of people who've already paid an annual subscription and we've got a bit of a dip in advertising revenues online. We'd be much better off to wait a year, hang on to the revenues, and then, I mean, they do have some valuable content, but you just can't help feeling that we're in a world now where you get reach first and then you get then revenue later. But the interesting thing about this is that you've now got a strategic battle between the Journal and the Financial Times, potentially for a worldwide business readership. If one of them goes fully free, they will really advantage themselves long term in terms of that battle.
But both of them seem quite nervous about doing that. They've not quite done it, have they?
I think that's because I think it's a bit of a fudge. I
mean, the FT say that they're putting their best content free, but it's not fully free.
It's not true, actually. You can't, because it's a random model. As Yen Chen says, actually, we're not selecting types of content to go behind a paywall, but then how irritating is it when you've looked at 30 articles and the 31st is actually a small, updated news story and it locks you out, you just go to another site. I think we'll see both of them largely out of the pay model within the next 5 years, and probably one of them completely out of it.
The other main publishers in the UK, at least, but also around the world, have gone mostly free. Times has done, Independent, Guardian, and Ian Waugh on our Facebook wall wonders about this. He's a user of The Guardian, and he says, I use a load of excellent free online resources and podcasts, but never buy any newspapers and seldom click on an ad. To what extent is the real world paper subsidising the online offering, if at all?
Well, it's obviously subsidising us with great deal of free content. We make money online if you take our sort of P&L as being the cost of digital. If you don't account for the cost of the free content, we don't make money in print. That's the same as a number of our competitors, most of our competitors.
But if you close down the Guardian newspaper tomorrow, you'd lose all that resource. So you're not really making money, are you?
Well, no, but this is a kind of a completely pointless and spurious argument because, you know, the issue is, if the Guardian were not free online, would people go out and buy the paper? No. We absolutely know that when people are online, they're a different type of reader than when they're offline. And if you're not providing what you do for free online, they will just go somewhere else online. They're not going to go, ooh, do you know what? I better go down the news agents. That sort of equation has, I think, definitely played out. We all know that it's better to have reach followed by revenue than dwindling reach.
Particularly with the advent of and the importance of search and Google, if you lock everything behind a subscription wall.
Yeah, exactly. It's so much more. It is about working with the web now. And Yen Chen did say something about this yesterday and saying that it was very important for the FT to be out there on search engines. And again, it's a well-known or an acknowledged fact now that what the currency we deal in now is not really publications, it's individual bits of content. And if you're not indexing on Google, people are not reading your journalism. So it is a different model, but free is definitely, definitely the way it is going, and I think it's the way it will continue to go.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
OK, one of the best attended sessions at the Changing Media Summit was the discussion about the future of audio, which I happen to be chairing. Now, the issue here isn't just about content and making money from it, it's also about the format. GCAP have got the wobbles about DAB, while upstarts like us here at The Guardian are getting involved in podcasts on the interweb. Guardian.co.uk/audio, by the way. We'll hear from BBC Radio's Andy Parfitt and media analyst Paul Robinson about the need to standardise the format for the next generation of radio shortly. But first, it's about this part of the show where we say it's about this part of the show where we discuss another week of woe for Channel 4 Radio. Well, Natalie Schwartz, chair of the 4 Digital Group and leader of Channel 4's successful bid for the second digital radio multiplex, was one of the speakers on my panel. We've really put the boot into her recently, so it's only right that we gave her a right to reply. I asked her about Maggie Brown's reports for Media Guardian that the Channel 4 board is getting cold feet about their entire radio experiment.
The board has made it clear that it remains committed to radio. Of course, the board are reviewing latest development in commercial digital radio in particular, and that brings both challenges and also opportunities. There are a number of cross-industry discussions going on, and the board remains confident that they will lead to a successful outcome and encourages both Ofcom and the government to play their part in making that a success.
Do you think that Channel 4 Radio and the second digital radio multiplex will launch in the form that they're currently envisaged?
Channel 4 Radio and the second digital multiplex were launched, but obviously this gives us an opportunity in the same way that the collapse of ITV Digital gave really a great opportunity to restructure the DTT landscape and gave birth to Freeview, which is obviously incredibly successful. That gives us the opportunity with a number of cross-industry discussions to see if there are other ways of reconfiguring the DAB landscape to give it and maximise all the potential benefits it can have nationwide.
So you do expect some restructuring, do you think?
I think a restructuring that in the same way that DTT gave rise to Freeview would be absolutely in the benefit of both UK listeners and the DAB digital radio industry. And as we've already made clear in our announcement a couple of weeks ago, Channel 4 and 4 Digital Group is working very closely with the BBC. And we've also made it very clear that other cross-industry initiatives working with the rest of commercial radio and key stakeholders will be a big part in making DAB an absolutely strong, confident part of the digital landscape.
So despite the jitters, There is a strong future for digital radio, for audio. You think that people want to get this stuff?
Yes, it's not just what I think, of course, it's the statistics. So consumers on the street are buying DAB sets, as you can see from the Christmas set sales. Over 6.5 million sets are now out there in the UK. And actually, not only are they buying the sets, but they're actually using those sets to consume the vast majority of their digital radio listening. So already 17% of all radio listening in the UK is to digital platforms, and 10% is to DAB radio. So to give you a sense of context, that's over 100 million listening hours. That's the size of the whole of BBC local radio.
Natalie Schwartz, this is very interesting, Emily, because that she's talking on the record for the first time saying that there needs to be some sort of restructuring of the digital radio proposition before Channel 4 Radio can launch.
Yes, you used the words opportunity. You used the word opportunity, and the word for opportunity in Chinese is the same as the word for crisis. Yeah, I'm not quite sure about the restructuring of digital audio to DAB. How is that going to happen? I can see how it happened with DTT, because you had a pay platform and you took it free. With DAB, it's a free platform. Where are you going to take it now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's very... because Channel 4 have obviously won this multiplex, and...
very valuable multiplex.
Very valuable multiplex, and that was how they were going to make their money. But they and a consortium have to build, however, a vast network of digital transmitters before you even start, OK? So there's all these digital transmitters...
it's ludicrous.
...have to be built, and then they have to attract a whole load of other operators onto their platform who will pay Channel 4 for the right to broadcast, and that's how they were going to make their model. Hmm. They make their money. But I'm assuming that they're trying to offload the bit about building all the transmitters.
Well, I was going to say, the restructure, therefore, would be we're not going to build we can't afford to build the transmitters. Hmm. Which is pretty much what Fru Hazlitt was saying from GCAP's point of view 3 weeks ago. Who's going to step in and put the money into building masts for a digital radio complex when clearly the way that audio is going to be distributed in the future is probably going to be through wireless broadband?
Well, Natalie Schwartz and others at the Changing Media Summit say that that's years away, and that we need to be talking about what we're doing
now. 5 years away, maybe. You know, but you know, I'm sorry, but the launch of Channel 4 Radio is years away. I mean, it's not. None of this is. They are stuck in a horrible bind, which is they are stuck with a bit of what's increasingly looking like interim technology. I mean, she does have a point in that. Consumers love DAB. I love my DAB sets. I wish I had DAB in the car. I'm sure that everyone who's bought a DAB set where there's a strong signal is very much in love with it. Most people are using their DAB sets to consume stations that are already available on analog. And well, I think that's going to be the tricky thing.
Well, it does seem that the most immediate problem facing radio, or should that be audio, is less about content and more about the platform on which it'll be delivered and just how will it all be broadcast. Now, here are a couple of people who should know a thing or two about this.
Andy Parfitt, controller of Radio 1, One Extra and the Asian Network.
Paul Robinson, Managing Director of Kids Co Worldwide.
It's very interesting that there's a big debate about format in digital radio at the moment. What's your view, Andy, about the DAB format and the different formats that there are around the world?
Well, it can get very confusing because they all have a D and M, a B and an A in them, and so it kind of tests the extent of your knowledge. But what is clear is that a format that is the same in Europe as it is in the Far East is hugely advantageous, and the UK, of course. And so DAB and DAB Plus are kind of accepted as standards.
So you're calling for at least a European-wide and possibly a worldwide format for digital radio?
Well, I'm not calling for it. I know that it's a sensible kind of solution to the challenges that DAB faces, and it's one of the questions that car manufacturers have about ensuring that, you know, line-fitting DAB radios that are destined for a market in Germany and the UK kind of is an important factor. It's just one of the questions, but it's an important one to ensure that that formats are as universal as possible. They're not going to be, because, of course, great big markets like the United States of America have satellite radio, and that's a kind of self-contained market in itself. But in Europe particularly, it's an important thing.
How important is format, Paul?
I think it's very important. I mean, we always knew the US was not going to be on board with the DAB standard or whatever standard we were going to adopt. But as Andy says, we hope there'd be an international standard across major markets. And a European standard alone will help, but may not be enough. I mean, the big problem here is that the big electronic manufacturers are in the Far East, and it's very hard to convince them to make for a market that's not their home market. You know, markets are converging, and we really need to try and get Japan, Korea on board with a European standard, ideally. If we could do that, I think we have a fundamental step forward. The issue about line fitting of car radios is important. Car radios are still an important part of this equation. And the fact it's taken us longer to get car radios, I think, has been to DAB's detriment. DAB's doing fine, but had we got car radios in, we'd be doing better than we are doing now.
What's your view, Andy, about the jitters around commercial digital radio at the moment?
Well, the jitters have been around the kind of commercial model for one of the big operators. The BBC is firmly committed to DAB, as we were talking about today at this conference. It's invested in the infrastructure and the services, and some very high-quality services. And we know that the future for radio must be about digital broadcasting, converged probably with broadband protocols as well, but for broadcasting purposes to mass audiences, DAB is absolutely essential, and the BBC is absolutely committed to DAB and looks forward to Channel 4 entering the market that will further boost the sales of DAB sets and the penetration of DAB.
We'll leave that there. You can follow all of this and full reports, in fact, from the Changing Media Summit on mediaguardian.co.uk. If you want to give us your thoughts, you can post a comment on the blog or on our Facebook wall. I'm Matt Wells. You're listening to Media Talk from The Guardian. Still to come, finally, ratings success for ITV. Gareth McLean will be here to tell us about The Fixer and the rest of the winners and losers of the TV week. Plus,
content is still king. The monetization and audience driving tools that provide customers with access to that content is a very, very close second. If the name of the game is to sell and resell the content that you've produced, the tools play a very important role in that.
We'll continue to gaze into the crystal ball of media and discuss the future of television and radio. That's all coming up. Emily, you were a fan of The Fixer, weren't you?
Yeah, I reviewed it for a BBC audio programme last week. Other audio programmes are also available. And I really liked it. And I felt slightly odd because Kirsty Lang, who was on the other audio programme, said to me, oh, God, it was just awful, wasn't it? And I thought, oh, no, has my taste antennae completely gone?
No, it was really fantastic, I thought.
It was really fantastic. Don't we love, what's his name? Thingy Buchan.
Andrew Buchan.
Andrew Buchan, we love him. Will he come in and do us an interview?
I'm sure he will.
I loved him on Party Animals as well, which the BBC was so wrong to decommission.
Well, that's just the BBC all over, isn't it? So ITV in good show shock.
Good show shock. Well, I was going to say, has there been a ticker tape parade on the South Bank?
I think there has.
Well, is there a national holiday?
More on all of that with Gareth McLean later. But first, he did such a good job in the presenter's chair last week that we've decided to keep him on in his usual feature. Here's Robert Freeman with a roundup of the week's other media stories making headlines over the past 7 days.
It's been a bad week for sub-editors after Britain's sixth largest regional newspaper owner announced plans to cut 20 subbing positions in favour of non-journalistic advertising designers. The Suffolk arm of Archon says it'll implement the staff consultation project with workers on the East Anglian Daily Times and the Ipswich Evening Star. The NUJ says the cuts would save the company about £170,000 a year, or £8,500 a sub. Bit of perspective for you. Archon just announced annual profits of more than £30 million. Moving on, there's better news though for teenage fans of Natasha Kaplinsky, because Five has struck a deal with MySpace to launch a youth-focused version of its news programme, hosted by the former BBC but still permatanned and now denim-wearing presenter. The MySpace news bulletin will be recorded each weekday after the 3 p.m. TV update on Five and posted online within 2 hours for the MySpacers. It'll be between 3 and 4 minutes long and tailored specifically for the social networking website's target audience of 16 to 34-year-olds, who'll probably get bored after 30 seconds and check up on Facebook. It's been a good week for restaurant reviewers after a Belfast court upheld the right of critics to ply their trade without risk of libel claims. The Northern Ireland Court of Appeal overturned a decision to award damages of £25,000 against the Irish News for a scathing review they published of Goodfellow's Pizzeria. The ruling's seen as a triumph for freedom of the press and the right to fair comment, but it doesn't make A.A. Gill any less of a git. And finally, congratulations to The Sun, who've been showing off dummies of its new look to media buying agencies. The nation's most loved tabloid is set to unveil its revamp in the next 2 months, which hasn't gone down too well with suits at the Daily Mirror, who said they had the idea to go all colour first. The new look Sun will apparently have colour-coded sections, meaning I'll never have to struggle to find page 3 again.
So, Emily, it's been a rather bad week for sub-editors. It seems that they're being axed by the East Anglian Daily Times.
They are. Designers.
I know, but now...
I like designers. I'm not sure I'd want to get rid of all my subs and replace them with them.
It does seem a very, very interesting... Well, this is a very interesting thing, because people wonder about what happens online, and certainly at The Guardian, and most, I think, other newspapers, on their online operations, we've kept sub-editors. They're very important
people. Our subs are bloody brilliant, because apart from anything else, they can do absolutely everything. They can crop pictures, they can put headlines up, they can rearrange trails, they can rearrange... You know, you can actually run... You can't run a site with someone who is just a writer. You can certainly run a site with someone who's just a sub. I wonder whether the East Anglian Daily Times are really thinking about whether they've got their skilling their subs right. I mean, I can see the point that they make about the amount of production resource you have to put into text. Is that sustainable on a long-term basis? Maybe not. Are your subs the best people in your building to, if you like, retrain to deliver some of these sort of exciting things online? Absolutely.
And also, interestingly, Natasha Kaplinsky is going to be on MySpace for the Channel 5 MySpace News Bulletin. MySpace seem to be getting into content into all sorts of ways, don't they? There's that horror film that they're doing as well.
Hammer Horror doing a... Yes, no, they are. But this has always been the way, and in fact, it's not really their content. It is, again, a Channel 5 bulletin.
Well, it's other people's content.
Other people's content sort of feeds into it. It's like having a bit of an RSS feed into Facebook. It's all very healthy. It's the way that you have to go. Go to where the audience is if they won't come to you.
Well, I spoke to Travis Katz, who's the Managing Director of International for Fox Interactive Media and MySpace, down at the Changing Media Summit. This is what he had to say.
If you look at the numbers, and the numbers tend to be fairly objective, social networking is one of the most popular phenomenons. Everyone in the UK is doing this now. I think more than 50% of Britons are using some sort of social network. MySpace alone reaches 28% of the UK audience. It's very, very mainstream. It's a platform. And if you are a content creator, there are tremendous opportunities for you to take advantage of this platform to distribute and monetize content.
But Emily, of course, the big social networking story of the week, unfortunately, isn't MySpace, is it?
It's Bebo. Lovely, lovely people at Bebo who
finally sold up.
$850 million to AOL. This is the moment at which the Web2 bubble burst. Because as soon as AOL buys your company, witness Time Warner in the web bubble 1.0, it's all over. And you just sort of think, $850 million seems like a lot of money. I think it's top of the market. I think that it's all downhill from here.
Didn't we say this before with MySpace, though, Emily? That Rupert Murdoch bought it for not a dissimilar amount of money, and it's now worth much, much more.
One of the few privileges of being in a declining industry like journalism is that you can carry on repeating yourself and contradicting yourself at great length on an almost a weekly basis, and nobody brings it up, Matt.
Do I contradict myself? Yes, I contradict myself.
No, you just contradicted me. Yes, we did say this before with MySpace, but then we were wrong. However, I do think there's something about the dead hand of AOL where you just think, I mean, you know, good luck to the fans of MySpace, of Bebo. They're lovely people. We like Bebo a lot. But you have to say, what are AOL going to bring to the party? I think it's going to be rather a flat six-pack.
They're even more useless than Yahoo, aren't they?
They're even more useless than Yahoo. Yeah. If there were such a category in international business as even more useless than Yahoo, do you know what? AOL would be right in there.
We'll leave all that net bashing there. You can follow all these stories and more at mediaguardian.co.uk. While we catch our breath, here's an ad.
On this week's Tech Weekly podcast, we dig up the dirt on the grand poobah of the blogosphere. Nick Denton is the man who's transforming the American media. Over in the USA, Jemima talks to participatory media guru Henry Jenkins, gives us the skinny on the Facebook keynote, and walks us through the new video sharing sites contending for the YouTube throne. All this and more on Tech Weekly, available on Tuesdays at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Media Talk from Guardian.co.uk.
Let's return for the final time to the Changing Media Summit. Well, we did organise the event in the first place. We've come a long way since the days when pressing the red button was deemed cutting-edge technology. Since then, TV has definitely gone OD. The iPlayer has done wonders with catch-up and streaming, and around 6 hours of video gets uploaded to YouTube every minute. But is it worth watching? Linear scheduling seems to be old hat, but is TV 2.0 simply just TV on the internet? And bearing in mind what we've just heard about the future of audio, what's more important, content or platform? Now, the first voice you'll hear in this segment is Barak Ben-Cohen, Chief Executive of Narrowstep.
very popular first name.
Absolutely.
Barrack.
Yeah,
he's the only other Barrack in the,
in the world.
Wait, do you know, you wait days for a Barrack and then two come along at once.
Well, there we are. This one is the chief executive of Narrowstep. Their company motto is, quote, the leader of monetizing content over the internet. Isn't that interesting? What a fabulous motto to have.
That is. I'd look forward to having that on my business cards. Never going to happen to The Guardian, but there you go.
It certainly isn't. Here's Barrack Ben-Cohen.
From my perspective, while content is still king, the monetization and audience-driving tools that provide customers with access to that content is a very, very close second. If the name of the game is to sell, sell, and resell the content that you've produced, the tools play a very important role in that.
Simon Nelson, controller of multi-platform for BBC Vision. From my point of view, the content's the most important element. The platform is a fantastic, liberating way of then getting that content to audiences in new ways at levels of convenience they've never dreamt of before. And the platform unquestionably gives you opportunities to change, to transform that content and to make sure it has greater impact. Making sure that you don't get overcomplicate things and actually undermine the key thing you're trying to make, which is a fantastic bit of content, is the most important thing. But spotting the opportunities that, you know, all these different extensions can now offer to reach out to people, to, you know, send, you know, use YouTube to find new audiences, to bring the audience closer to it, potentially to influence it, to shape it, to make a better bit of content, to make sure that the discussion's going on around it, you're forming communities around it. I mean, it's choosing the right thing at the right moment, but making sure it doesn't undermine, but actually strengthens and builds the core bit of content.
Ian McCallan, Director of Digital Media for Turner Broadcasting. Now that there's a myriad of platforms and opportunities and content formats, you actually just need more people and they all need to communicate well. So when we're commissioning a new show, then in that room will be the traditional commissioners and developers, there'll be licensing and merchandise people, there'll be digital media people, there might be a game developer. So we'll pick and choose what people we need in that room and they'll each be responsible for their component of that content and the version of that content, and it's just vital that they all communicate throughout that process.
More people means more expense, though. That means you have to make more money, and a fractured audience lessens the chances of that.
I think with the opportunities becomes more revenue opportunities as well. So, you know, 15 years ago we'd never dream of making, you know, console games for one of our cartoons, but now we can, and you can sell that game, and there's an additional revenue stream. So those additional revenue streams pay for the additional people.
All right, do you think that the content providers are making best use of the platforms and technologies they have available?
I think they are, and I actually think folks like BBC and Turner are in an excellent position to be the great monetizers of content in the future.
You'll bounce at that you've got one of them on either side of you.
Well, there you go. Very well put. I really do. We are a big believer in long-form, professionally produced, high-quality content. And that's what we're seeing advertisers demanding as well. No one wants their logo next to something that doesn't look good and is produced well, and no one wants to have their logo and their brand associated with something that isn't in a controlled, high-quality environment, and that's what we do. So we actually believe in companies that can continue to produce high-quality, professional content, and that's basically where we're spending our time.
So you wouldn't necessarily say that the platforms and the technology is too complicated?
As far as we're concerned, like in any disruptive business environment, it's going to come down to technology and it's going to come down to standardization. There was a time 10, 12, 15 years ago when you needed millions of dollars and a whole room of people to launch a website. Today, any 16-year-old with 10 bucks a month and access to GoDaddy can do it. That's not here today, but that will be here tomorrow.
Barrack Ben-Cohen, Simon Nelson, Ian McClellan there. The Guardian's head of video, Robert Freeman, was asking the questions. Emily, it's interesting that Barrack Ben-Cohen was talking about the BBC being one of the great monetizers of content online.
Yes, well, thank you. Hallelujah, I've been saying for years. It's just they're like this kind of behemoth, which was a word which was bandied around quite a lot yesterday as well. They do make a phenomenal amount of money out of extending their brands. We've heard about what they're doing around Top Gear and various other programme brands through BBC Worldwide. They're carrying ads on those. They're just about to launch sort of 500 million web pages a month or something into the States as advertising inventory. They're just launching, interestingly enough, an environment site, which is pretty much built and contributed to by what one might have considered to be print journalists. I mean, this is, you know, this is kind of, I don't know what the Trust are doing with their time these days, but this is a fairly formidable money-making machine.
And making money in Britain as well. After 7 days, of course, you'll be able to buy programmes now online for however much it's going to be, £1
which you've already paid for.
Well, this is why, very interestingly, this week it was revealed that hackers have hacked the iPlayer in protests.
That was me.
Was that you?
If only I had those skills.
Saying that, well, we've paid for this content already.
Paid for this content already, and I know they'll go, oh, there are rights things, etc. No, we've paid. It's like a museum. We've paid for it. Let us see it. And I think that Mark Thompson has for a long time thought there is going to be no license fee in the future. I've thought this for years. That almost as soon as he got there, he started this commercialisation process at the BBC, which is now really acquiring some pretty serious momentum.
Can the current broadband system support all these intentions, not just of the BBC, but of everybody? Or do you think that there's going to have to be some sort of overhaul of the broadband infrastructure?
Depends who you listen to. If you listen to scientists who know about this thing, these things, they say actually with compression rates and the amount of capacity in the network, there's plenty of room for it. If you listen to some of the providers, they're going, oh, it's going to be very tricky. You might have to end up paying a bit more. You know, we may well be into the same sort of debates that they've had in the States about net neutrality and who pays for this and is it going to be user pays? Is it going to be content provider pays? You can't help feeling that sort of 10 to 20 years ago, we had, I think, the first glimmers of, well, one day we'll be able to send TV pictures down the line, down telephone lines. And everybody said, no, it'll never happen. You'll never be able to get compression rates up that far. I think where there is fibre at the core, there's plenty of capacity, as I say, if you listen to specialists. But, you know, it is going to be a bun fight around this, I'm sure.
Well, I think that's more than enough jargon and policy wonkery for one thing. No, it wasn't too much jargon there. There's going to be a big bun fight about it.
People who listen to this are meant to be media professionals, for God's sake.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Emily Bell. Gareth McLean is next. I'm back. You're back as well. But
I am back. Oh, I've missed you terribly, Matt.
I know. I didn't miss you.
No, I know you didn't.
holiday. I was going to
holiday. Is that what you're calling it now?
Well, I tell
convalescing
you,
after a boob job.
I most certainly. I was going to tell you about one of my nights I had in Montreal, but I won't now.
Bucks and Matt Wales.
What's been happening while I've been away? Well, I tell you what. ITV have had not a bad week. We were talking about this earlier.
ITV have good week. Shocker. Not only did the Bionic Woman do great guns for ITV2, but The Fixer, not a biopic of Jimmy Savile, a joke I've made before, but it's still funny. Well, or isn't as it's funny. Still just as funny as it was, which maybe isn't very much. But anyway, great.
I really liked the Bionic Woman. Yeah, I thought it was fabulous. But it's apparently it's not going to be commissioned.
No, it's been axed, which obviously is good news for it doing really well on ITV2.
Absolutely. But I would imagine
The Fixer has been commissioned for like three more series, and they'll be doing a kids spin-off. And then another spin-off somewhere else.
I have Sky Plus'd it.
Have you?
Was it
very
good?
It was good. And I think
so what's the premise for those of us who haven't seen it?
It's about a state-sponsored assassin who, you know, finds himself torn between wanting to live a nice, quiet life, but he's been sprung from prison, and he's sort of at the behest of Peter Mullen, who plays Peter Mullen.
I thought you could say he's been at the behest of Peter Fincham, that's why Simon Shapps has been sacked.
Simon Shapps sleeps with the fishes. No, so it's good. And also, I think the success is important because the drama on ITV needs to work, just for everyone's sake, because we can't have the BBC drama department getting too arrogant or any more arrogant than they already are. And it just puts paid to the notion that ITV audiences don't want new, darker, more difficult, grown-up, different things.
Well, this is part of the problem because they've been throwing a whole lot of new stuff out there, but it's been that sort of, you know, tacky, badly thought through and ill-conceived sort of stuff rather than more of the sort of quality stuff like this, The Fixer.
Well, I mean, in He Kills Coppers that's coming up, what I think people are drawn to in a drama is its confidence in itself. The Fixer knows what it is in a way that The Palace didn't really know what it was. I'm slightly confused that Rock Rivals isn't doing as well as it might do, because it knows what it is as well. You know, it doesn't think it's Cranford. Mm. It knows, you know, it's shiny and silly and a bit sort of raucous. So I'm curious as to why that's not working. I'm not so curious as to why the white season isn't working on BBC Two. Oh, that'll be because it's misconceived and stupid. Have you watched any of it?
I haven't. Actually. I have seen those trails for it, though.
Oh, that's creepy.
With the creepy Richard Klein.
I haven't caught any kind of objections to that on, like, sort of racist grounds. So there's a sort of a whole debate being going on Comment Is Free about the man getting written on. But it just reminds me of that episode of Doctor Who, do you remember, with the devil in it, where the guy had all the things written on his face. It's absolutely terrifying. Anyway,
misconceived and ill thought through.
Yeah, well, what I mean.
So misconceived, what, they shouldn't have done it, or
not necessarily? No, but what they're doing is they're couching issues that are actually class issues in ethnic terms.
Right.
You know, it's not like the black and Asian working class are having a great time. It's all hugs and puppies for them. You know, the white working class. Do you know what I mean? Those are the issues it's tackling. It's poverty. It's about poverty, and that's a colorblind thing, isn't it?
Well,
poverty.
There we are.
Having said that, I did think White Girl was quite good. That was the drama in the middle of all the sort of boring documentaries.
Marvellous. Excellent. We're done for another week. Thank you very much to Gareth and to Emily earlier on, and everyone who didn't flinch at our comedy microphone when we thrust it in their general direction down at the Changing Media Summit. If you want to comment on any of the topics we've discussed, head to our blog on Organ Grinder or post a comment on our Facebook wall. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.